This hour, we'll take your calls with Donna Kaufman as we talk about her latest work, The JFK Assassination Dissected. Jump on board when we come back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Donna Kaufman with us. This hour, we'll take your phone calls as we talk about her latest work, The JFK Assassination. But you've got three other great books out there, too, Donna.
Yeah, George, you did such a great interview with Cyril. Oh, wonderful.
Thank you.
Great questions.
He's easy to interview because he is so powerful in what he says.
Yeah, he's got his spiel down, doesn't he? He's amazing.
Oh, my God, he's something. 90 years old.
Yeah, he makes the rest of us look like we're standing still.
If I could act and sound like him when I'm 90, I'll still be on this show.
Yeah, well, I expected you to. But, you know, it really comes from having the knowledge and being angry that people are being hoodwinked.
Yep.
But I'm a little more hopeful than he is about people finding answers. I think that new generations of people will find things in their attic from their grandparent and look at boxes that they never knew information from and find out things. Who told Gerald Ford to move that bullet wound? Who told, you know, there are a lot of people, we get into this in the book, a lot of questions that can be answered. And if it's not going to come out through the archives and Joe Biden is not going to release everything, which, you know, good luck if he is, hooray, but we have to expect that we have to get answers in other means. And part of that is just people power.
Absolutely. Yeah, Jerry was, of course, a congressman from Michigan, so I knew a lot about him, with Detroit being my hometown.
Oh, yes.
There's no way he would have come up with this on his own, Donna.
No. He was probably one of the first cases of CTE, you know, just from all his injuries on the playing field as a footballer. Not known for his brain power, but he certainly could take orders. So who gave him his marching orders?
Exactly. See, when Nixon replaced Spiro Agnew with him, he wanted someone who was just nice and wouldn't cause waves, and Jerry Ford was that kind of guy.
Yes. Not a bad guy. You know, these are not bad people. They were just forced to do this under the rubric that they were doing the right thing to prevent a war with Russia.
Right.
And part of our book gets into the challenges that Cyril faced with people like Vince Bugliosi, who wrote a book, like 1,400-page book about why the Oswald acted alone, and also the guy who created the myth of the single bullet theory, Arlen Specter, who was an attorney on the Warren Commission and then became a senator of Cyril's own state. And he liked him personally. He even supported him, even though he was a Republican, for his Senate run. And when he died, Cyril wrote something for his memorial. And when Vince Bugliosi died, even though they were at each other's throats when it came to debating this JFK case, Vince asked his family, please get Cyril to give a memorial for me, because he knew he was going to die. So I think there's a lot of mutual respect there, even though they were on opposite sides, opposite teams when it came to this case.
Lee Harvey Oswald had two daughters. Has anybody ever talked to them?
Yes, two daughters. Well, we get into this friendship that Cyril had with Marina, and that's very interesting. She really spilled her guts with because their children were about the same age, and they're adults now, and they're out there doing good things. They live
and the wife has been remarried. She's remarried, isn't she?
Yes, remarried and divorced, but they still lived together. And then she had a son with Kenneth Porter. And, you know, she's a contributing member of society. And the kids grew up well. They're educated. They're passionate kids. But they want to know what happened to their dad. And why did he make these choices? You know, they're not delusional about, you know, he was a wonderful guy. No, he was a lousy father. He was a lousy husband. But something got into his brain. And, you know, why did he make the choices that he did? We're not absolving him of all guilt in our book. You know, there's a lot of question about why he made choices he did.
Well, and he knew some of the players. He knew Ruby, didn't he?
Well, that's people say he did. Are there photos of them together? No. But, you know, maybe in somebody's attic there's a photo. That's the kind of stuff that could come out and change everything. But right now we can't prove anything like that. You know, a lot of this case, there were the CIA renegades, people who were in the CIA and were fired, were the people who came up with this plot. Then there was the moving the body to Bethesda instead of doing the autopsy with a competent forensic pathologist in Dallas.
Right.
No, they
and the coroner
military installation so they could control it.
The coroner wanted the body in Dallas.
He should have. But you know, at gunpoint, it was taken away from him, and we get into all of that too. And given to completely useless pathologists, not forensic pathologists, but pathologists who generally looked at slides of cancers and stuff. They weren't there to do. They had never done gunshot autopsies. So they were pushed around and intimidated by the military brass that was controlling everything. And then they thought, okay, we got this down. Now we know we can control the case. And then they find out there's this Pruder film,
Which
took some time to come out because at that, you know, it's not like today where you take a...
Everybody's got a smartphone.
And you take something and put it on the internet. Then you had to take that footage and bring it to a laboratory and get it blown up and get it assessed. So all that stuff took time. But that was a timeline to what happened in the motorcade, and it showed the movement of the head. So then the plotters had to say, oh, now we got to, you know, deal with that. So that kind of thing continued and continued. And then the bullet, the magic bullet that appeared on a gurney in Parkland Hospital by very much could have been Jack Ruby who dropped it there. That was another thing they had to accommodate. So they were having to, oh boy, clean up their mess as they went along. And part of that mess meant getting the media, the mainstream media, to go along. So things like when Mark Lane wrote his book, he couldn't get it published in America. It had to come out of England. Some of the best documentaries have come out of England. So America still has reticence about telling the truth up until Oliver Stone, who wrote our foreword, by the way, and he brought Cyril in to explain some of the things to him and Kevin Costner about the trajectory, about the demonstrating.
Well, and Cyril was a consultant to that movie, wasn't he?
He certainly was. And they're still fast friends. And there's a two-hour documentary now on Showtime that has Cyril in it, and it's called Through the Looking Glass, the JFK film revisited, and because it came out in 1991, I believe, and a lot has happened. Thanks to Oliver Stone, that's who made sure that the public was demanding that the files be released, the declassified files.
That's right.
So thanks to him and thanks to Bill Clinton, who released hundreds of thousands of documents, and there have been dribbles since. We thought when Trump came in, he would, you know, he's a renegade. Let's see him release documents, but he never did. But now the time is ripe for Biden to do that. And if they're still holding back stuff, you know, there are other ways for information to get out there.
Well, President Biden's got to do something to get his popularity poll up, doesn't he?
Well, I think he'll be fine. You know, COVID has had a bad effect on all sorts of parts of life.
All of them. Yep, sure has. Let's go to the phones. Eric, truck driving in Indiana. Hello there, Eric.
Hello, George. How are you today?
I'm great, thanks.
Great, great. I got a good guest on tonight. I missed part of your show tonight. I was going to ask a question about if she's ever done any research on James File.
Yes, I have. I think there's a mention of him in the book. There are a lot of people who have stories and have come forward and said, "Yeah, I was one of the assassins," and or their relatives have said that. They just need to be checked out. I'm not convinced of James File's story, but it certainly is intriguing. And some of the other people who have come forward, or have others brought them forward, also have interesting stories. Listen, this it wasn't one person. There was probably a team on the Daltex building. There was a team in the Texas School Depository, and there was a team on the Grassy Knoll. And it wasn't just shooters. There were people there, experts in assassinations, who unassembled the rifles and packed them away and marched off with them. So, and by the way, there were dry runs in Miami and Chicago prior to Dallas. So this wasn't a one-man operation. And all these people who come forward, like James Files, who have information, they have to be really given some scrutiny and find out if they're accurate, if their stories make sense.
Or if they're nuts. Now, Files, he's 80, 79 years old now, claims that he was the Grassy Knoll shooter.
Right. He may well have been. He may well have been.
How could somebody say that, basically make themselves seem guilty, and nobody charges them with anything?
Yeah.
If you walked into
he doesn't have to worry about it.
If you walked into a police department and say, "I just murdered somebody and somebody did die," they're going to arrest you.
Yeah.
Nobody arrested him.
If only this case were handled like a normal homicide would be handled, with the forensic evidence and the court cases that would ensue. But no, nobody wants to go to that extreme. And instead, they call us conspiracy nuts. So, fine, call us all you want, but let's see some forward movement on this. One of the other things that's frustrating to me, and I know to Cyril as well, is John Connolly had bullets fragments in his wrist that could have been taken out as and analyzed.
Mm-hmm.
That would have proven that the bullet CE-399 is the bullet was not the bullet that did all that magic stuff.
Because it would have shown some of Kennedy's DNA. Of course, I don't know if they had DNA in those days.
Well, we have it now. That's why the brain would have been really interesting to look. Just because it's been shot away doesn't mean that there isn't some kind of...
Somebody's got the brain somewhere, Donna.
Yeah, somebody's got it. Somebody's got it, or it's been deep-sixed. but I suspect somebody's got it. It's in someone's attic. But, you know, that's the kind of thing. So, when John Connally died, Cyril went to Janet Reno, who was Attorney General, and said, please ask the family of Connally to let us have that the metal filings in his wrist so that we can analyze it, and it won't affect, you know, he could still have his funeral, open casket, it won't affect anything, you won't even see it, but just have somebody competent go in there and take those, because if there are enough of them, then it will prove that that bullet could not have been the bullet that did all that damage. And so she asked, and the family said no. And then when Nellie died, the family still said no. So the other person who's been an obstructionist through all of this is Caroline Kennedy, who put a 100-year ban not long ago on releasing her mother's clothing. You know, there could be some forensic evidence on that clothing, which has not been laundered.
Oh, you mean the pink outfit?
The pink outfit. The hat is missing. That went missing some time ago. But the outfit, her pink outfit, certainly could have bullet fragments on it that could be tested.
It had blood on it for sure.
For sure. But we know whose blood it was. But if there are bullet fragments that do not match the bullets that we know about, that is worth looking at. And why did Caroline put that? Well, again, the trauma of the family overwhelms their need for forensic evidence. And the person who would have been open to that was John Jr., who was more analytical and had actually read a lot of information about his father's assassination. But unfortunately, he's not here.
He's not here. And he had some presidential possibilities himself, didn't he?
Well, I would have voted for him. I would have. He was a very smart guy and a very caring person. Just all the attributes that you want in a president. But I don't know that he would have. He was running a magazine, and he had a lot of other careers going. So I don't know if he had the interest in doing that. But
magazine was called George, wasn't
it? George Magazine, yes.
Interesting. Not after me, off after George Washington, I think.
Oh, I thought it was after you.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. Where do people get your book?
Amazon or McFarland Books, McFarland Books. But just go to Amazon. You can get the book itself, or you can get an e-book. So either way.
All right, Donna, we're going to come back in just a moment and take final phone calls with you. Those of you on hold, we will do our best to get all of you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM with Donna Kaufman. On our next Coast to Coast program, we'll be talking to a spiritual teacher about strange things. And then later on in the program, we'll be talking with a metaphysical teacher as well about higher states of consciousness. And don't forget, we will be live on Thanksgiving night for you here on Coast to Coast. Back with our final segment with Donna Kaufman, author of The JFK Assassination Dissected. What are you working on next, Donna?
Well, that's a good question. It's either going to be another collection of true crimes or my own book as a part Nancy Drew and part comedian, because I've worked on a lot of television comedies, and I still do write TV comedy. I worked on, I was a writer on SNL, many other shows.
Oh, cool.
So I have kind of an interesting life, you know, a bifurcated life of these two different careers that are all research-based.
On SNL, ever work with Danny Aykroyd?
Yes, I saw him at SNL. I never worked with him. I was there in the 90s, the late 90s or middle 90s, and he would come around and watch the shows. So I never actually, you know, worked with him, but Nice guy.
Good guy. Loves our show. Listens all the time.
Yeah, I bet. And just a genius comedian. I mean, he really, he was fantastic.
They're coming out with a new Ghostbuster movie.
I think it's out, yes.
It's out, yeah.
Yeah, good.
How cool is that? All right, let's go to the phones. Bill in Los Angeles, welcome to the program, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi, George and Donna.
Hi there.
Hey, Bill.
Friends from high school worked with on Saturday Night Live in the late 70s, so it's a small world.
Yes.
Yeah, Donna, I reported Dr. Weck's criticisms of the New York City Medical Examiner's contradictory conclusions in my Columbia J School master's project on the Michael Stewart police homicide trial in 1985. Do you recall that?
Gosh, I don't. But, you know, he's done, 62,000 cases. So I don't know that, but I bet he'd know it, and he would remember every single element about it if you had a chance to talk to him about it.
Right. Yeah, I was disappointed that I couldn't ask him about that. But I did want to point out that I don't believe that the forensics that you allude to changed the basic facts of the Sirhan case. And I have no axe to grind. I'm nonpartisan, and I've never even really been a Kennedy fan. But I think that the facts remain that Sirhan voiced hatred for Kennedy's stance on Israel and the Palestinians, so he had motive, and he did bring a loaded weapon to the Ambassador Hotel for whatever reasons, and he did discharge it a few feet from Senator Kennedy, and he struck numerous people, which amounts at least to attempted multiple murder, and he was convicted by a jury of his peers, and that's enough for a sane person to want that guy to stay in jail away from other innocent people that he could harm for the rest of his life.
Well, he has been in jail since 1968, but he did not kill Kennedy, and that's why he's in jail. He absolutely did not. There was no way he could have. But, you know, he's not a perfect guy. I mean, he did shoot his gun. He connected those bullets with five different people, all who survive, and who are now supporting that he be released. So that matters, too.
Now, the governor, though, has the power to say no, right?
Exactly. And is the governor going to stand up to Ethel Kennedy, 93 now? I don't know how. You know, she wrote a letter. I don't know if one of her kids wrote it.
Well, the former congressman, his brother, Joseph Kennedy, RFK Jr.'s brother, he's opposed to parole as well.
Yeah, they're all opposed except for Robert Jr. and another family member. And the former Attorney General of Maryland is the sister who was for it, Sirhan being released, and now she's like measuring her family's reluctance and isn't taking a stand now. But we get into all of that in the book. And, you know, the thing is, again, they're not looking at this as for the forensic evidence. Look at the evidence and then tell me where the flaw is, because the flaw is keeping this man in jail. He did not do this crime.
Frank in Hollywood, Florida. Franco, go ahead.
Who hired Lee Harvey Oswald at the school book depository? How long was he employed before the assassination?
A short time.
The assassination. Why wasn't he issued a collapsible state-of-the-art sniper's rifle with a silencer on it?
All good questions. And first of all, they did not know Kennedy's route until really late into the event, right?
Yes, and there was some question about why did they... you'd think that if Lee Harvey Oswald was going to take out the president, he would do so from that window as the car came toward him, not, you know, from the back, not after it had passed the building and turned. So that's a real, that nobody has explained that. There are some people who had control of the motorcade route, who should have been looked at a lot closer. In fact, one of the people is somebody who was involved in the decision for Robert Kennedy to go through the kitchen instead of his previous route, which was after he finished his speech, which was so well received. So there are other people who really have to be brought, you know, onto the carpet and grilled. If there were, if this were a true investigation, that would have happened. Of course, the LAPD made certain to get rid of all the, you know, proof of other bullets. There were 13 gunshots found in the door jams and other parts of that kitchen route, and that was all destroyed. They didn't want to spend the time to store that that stuff, so they just destroyed it. So, I mean, it's just ridiculous. Somebody who robs a liquor store has better forensics and investigation into their crime than happened with the senator or JFK.
How long did Oswald work at the school book depository? Do we know that?
Well, he was a ne'er-do-well who had spotty employment in Dallas as well as...
Yeah, he was fired from all his other jobs,
yeah,
wasn't he?
He was just there taking orders from somebody. But he was at the school book depository only for a couple of weeks before this happened.
Next up, let's go to Cornelius in Louisiana. Hello there, Mr. White. Welcome to the show.
Hey there, George and Donna.
Hey.
I've been waiting for this forever. I was telling Tommy Danheiser, my attorney was Richard B. Burns. He worked with Jim Garrison, Big Jim, down there in New Orleans. He knew something about the Kennedy assassination because Jim Garrison was investigating it. He believed, but now he didn't tell me the names or anything, but he believed the military and the mob, just like George believed the mob was behind it. But Big Jim Garrison was right on top of it. So I don't know if you cover Big Jim's.
Oh, there's a huge yes, because Cyril was involved in that investigation, and he was going to testify. And then the case against a guy who was a local CIA-connected businessman there, Clay Shaw, that fell apart. He went to he was going to testify. Cyril was going to testify, and then didn't. There's a huge chapter on Garrison and that. Why did he go after this guy? He didn't have his ducks in a row, is the best I could say. But Clay Shaw definitely was somebody worth looking at. And the whole thing, that spooky town in New Orleans, I mean, New Orleans really is another player in this whole mystery, because that's where Oswald worked for a long time. Again, he was brought down there to do some intelligence work, and it didn't quite make sense, but he was there to do some shifty things, and... It's just another player in this whole case.
First-time caller Ronald's with us in Springfield, Missouri. Hi, Ron. Go ahead.
Yes, I want to talk about the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Yes, sir.
I read the book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination, written by Lamar, that his first name.
Waldron.
I do not remember his last name.
Waldron.
Investigative journalist. Did you read that book?
Yeah, Lamar. He's been a guest on the show. Lamar,
right.
Waldron.
That's one of the early books that came out.
Well, his book arrived at the bookstores about 2 or 3 weeks after November 22 of... Anyway. Now, he was convinced that the mafia did it all, that they planned it, and they planned the, they arranged for the assassins. But the elderly man, Cyril, Cyril who talked, he said it was not. He said the assassination was actually planned by people in the United States government, people in the FBI and the military. And what do you think about that? And before they cut me off, Lamar found information from the United States archives in Washington, D.C. that had just recently been declassified when he found it. And he learned about a secret tape recording of the talking by, I think it was Marcello.
Yes, Carlos Marcello.
Right.
The mafia leader in Texas. And there was he didn't know it, but his voice was recorded when he was in prison. And he said he caused the assassination of Kennedy. And
being self-grandiose there. He definitely was mad at the Kennedys, but believe me, the mafia, the best of the mafia, would not have had the access that was necessary to pull off this this coup, as well as the cover-up, which included the autopsy, because the autopsy, the Parkland doctors saw certain wounds that the autopsy doctors didn't see and didn't question. So that was all military. It was CIA, intelligence, a little bit of FBI, and it was military all the way for the cover-up. And the mafia had very little to do with it. They might want to take credit because it looks good on their resume, but they just didn't have the means or the ability to do this kind of stuff. But, you know, when Johnny Rosselli, for example, was going to testify, we know what happened to him. He ended up cut up in pieces and put into...
an oil drum.
Oil drums, yeah. So, you know, these guys weren't going to say anything, but...
Don't forget Dorothy Kilgallen. She had information, too, and look what happened to her.
Yeah, people who... there were a lot of people who had little bits of attempts to get make public things, and that still is our best hope. You know, people who... Cyril is involved and was one of the founders of Citizens Against Political Assassinations, CAPA. And they just finished an annual seminar, which was like a 3-day conference. And this is where the great thinkers on this case coordinate, look at material. If people have something in their, you know, a box in the attic that they don't know what the value is, it's like Antiques Roadshow. You give it to Kappa, let the brain trust there look at it. They know how to evaluate stuff. So that's where I have hope that we will still find answers.
All right, my friend Donna.
Whether or not the government wants to help us out or not.
Thanks for being on the program, Donna. Keep in touch with us, of course, with all your latest work. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasor, Timothy Banal, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Ian Punnett, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.